Welcome to the Revitalize My Church podcast, created to help churches navigate change and reorient to a new and healthy future. Here's the host of the show, Bart Blair.
Welcome to episode 36 of the Revitalize My Church podcast. My name is Bart Blair. It's my privilege to welcome you to this edition of the show. We've been producing this podcast since the summer of 2024 with the goal of helping churches navigate change and reorient to a new and fruitful future. I have the privilege of serving as the Director of Church Revitalization for a ministry called Assist Church Expansion. That's who produces this podcast. And we release two episodes every month, one on the first of the month and one on the 15th of the month. The first of the month is typically a conversation between myself and my ministry colleague, Nathan Bryant, who's the executive director of our ministry. And then on the 15th of the month, I bring in a guest, someone that I want to learn from, and I interview them so that I can learn and I can share those learnings with you. And that's exactly what I have to share with you today. I had the opportunity recently to sit down with Jim Tomberlin and to talk specifically about church mergers, something that maybe you haven't thought about before, maybe something not familiar with. I first came across Jim Tomberlin probably, I want to say 2011 or 2012. He and Warren Bird had written and published a book called Better Together, which is a book about church mergers. And I remember reading the book and just having my mind blown because there was a concept that I'd never really considered, that churches could actually merge together. I've heard of churches splitting, but I hadn't really been familiar with churches merging. Over the course of the last 12 or 15 years of ministry, I've seen that happen more and more frequently. And I had the opportunity to meet Jim last summer at a workshop that I was doing, and we hit it off, and I invited him to be on the show, and he was gracious enough to give us about 45 minutes of his time today to talk about his book, about church mergers, and to be an encouragement to you, our audience. So I hope that you will appreciate this conversation with Jim as much as I enjoyed taking part in this conversation. We'll link to his book and all other things in the show notes as we usually do. And I will wrap up the introduction to this podcast and get on with the interview. So here we go. Here's my recent interview with Jim Tomberlin. Well, Jim Tomberlin, I am so excited to have the opportunity to hang out with you this afternoon. Thanks so much for giving me your time.
Well, it's great to be with you again, Bart, and looking forward to it.
Yeah, this is going to be a really, really great conversation. And your ministry journey is one that has been filled with a lot of different things. Why don't you start by just kind of sharing a little bit of your background and how you got to where you are today?
Well, hey, I've been a pastor in pastoral ministry for five decades, Bart. So and
that's my whole life, Jim. My whole life. You've been a minister my whole life.
And, you know, and it's not slowing down, and I actually still love it. And I've served several churches over the years, and you know, I'm grateful that I can go back to any of those churches, and have gone back to those churches, and always welcomed as the former beloved pastor and friend. And so I'm grateful for that. And I had the privilege to be one of the early pioneers in the 1990s with the whole multi-site church movement, and that evolved into our conversation today, where church mergers have become a major component of the multi-site movement. In fact, the multi-site movement, as we described in our first book on church mergers, was the primary catalyst for this new kind of mergers we're seeing today. But in our second edition, about 10 years later, that we updated, and we also discovered there are other motivations why churches are pursuing mergers beyond just the multi-site option. So, but anyway, that's what my role has been. And for the last 20 years, after being a pastor for 20 plus years, I have been consulting for the last 20 years. I just saw that 20 years and 5 months on my LinkedIn account just recently. And I thought, you know, I thought I would do this for 3-4 years and then go back to being a pastor. And so I'm still doing this 20 plus years later. But people ask me, do you miss being a pastor? And I say, no, I'm actually still pastoring. I pastor pastors, and they're a whole lot more needier than regular churchgoers. So,
no offense to the pastors listening out there, but I agree with you 100%. Yeah. Yes, that is.
No,
that
and
is.
I'm honored to do that. I'm glad to be a friend to pastors. And because I are one, we have affinity with each other and safety with each other. So.
Yeah, that's excellent. And I appreciate your heart as well. We got to spend a little bit of time in person together last year, and I definitely, I've known of you for a very long time, and I was unaware, really, I guess, about as much of your pastoral background. But when I met you and hung out with you, I was like, well, this guy's a pastor. I can tell he's a pastor. So even though you may not wear the title as your as your moniker day in, day out. You definitely have a pastor's heart. I appreciate that about you. Speaking of my familiarity with you, I bought a book going back, I want to say 2011 or 2012, called Better Together, a conversation basically written by you and Warren Bird about church mergers. And it, you know, I'd never read anything quite like it. It was really, really eye-opening for me at the time. And so I've known of you for a very long time. And then we got to meet each other in person last year. And then I thought, you know, this would be a really, really great conversation for our audience here to talk about what church mergers look like, mostly because so much of the framework comes from an idea of a church revisioning, revitalizing, restarting. And we're going to talk about some of those details and some of that language as we get going here. I must admit, I've read your book twice now. I haven't read the updated version. I'm assuming it's way better than the first version. But I have read it a couple of times, and I've got some specific questions.
Shameless plug.
There you go.
The updated version, 2020 came out.
It's beautiful. I love the colors on that. Great design. So anyway, we'll link to the book in the show notes, but I think we're going to unpack some things here in our conversation that will really help people get their heads around really what a church merger is, when it's not appropriate, and some of the things that churches ought to ask themselves, some pitfalls that they might want to look out for, and really I just want to pick your brain about this. And so I'm going to jump right in, and I'm going to bring out some statistics and have you just kind of speak to some of these things here. One of the things that you write in the book is that there are more than 300,000 Protestant churches in the United States. The numbers vary depending on what reports you're looking at. And you state that about 60% of those churches are stuck and about 20% of those churches are in serious trouble. They're in decline and not stagnant, but actually moving towards closure. Some of the pastors that are listening to this podcast or watching on our YouTube channel are probably pastoring churches that are stuck or perhaps in serious trouble. When you hear that data, or when I state that data, what should that actually mean for those pastors, for those church leaders from a practical standpoint?
Well, yeah, we've done that survey numerous times in different ways over the years, of what category are churches in. It may vary a few percentage points, but generally you got about 20% strong, about 60% stuck, and about 20% struggling. And so when it comes to church mergers, who's the best beneficiary of those? Well, or who's the best candidate to be in a merger conversation or have a merger happen to them or be a part of a merger? Actually, all three of them. For a strong church, this is a way for extending their impact, accommodating their growth. The multi-site church movement has been a major catalyst, as I mentioned already, for church mergers. And so this is a way for strong churches to multiply themselves across a greater region. But for struggling churches, the other end, about 20% on the other end, those who are in preservation mode or life support, a merger is a wonderful option for them, a wonderful option in the sense of we could have a rebirth, a second life, a second chapter, or we close our doors and our ministry is over forever. I just saw there was a book came out about 2 years ago in 2024 by a mainline church leader, denominational leader, who wrote the book was titled Gone for Good. Mm. And it was basically a book all about that he basically predicts that about 100,000 church facilities will be sold or repositioned by the year 2030. We're talking 5 years from now.
Wow.
And so that's 100,000 church facilities that are good candidates. And there's another option. He didn't even talk about this. There's another option. You could actually join with another church and give new life and renewal and rebirth to a replant, as sometimes we describe this, to a location, to a church that's maybe 30 years old, 100 years old, 150 years old. I've worked with all those different ages of churches. And so those churches on the struggling end of the spectrum are great candidates for a rebirth. Now, the stuck churches, that's about 60% or so. Merger is a possibility for being revitalized, but there's many other options for them besides a merger. I would say that, that they... they can pull out of that if there's a willingness to define reality, get help either from the denomination or their network or from my former partners, the Unstuck group, which are masterful at helping churches get unstuck. And so there are these, but all three categories are good candidates for a merger conversation.
Yeah. You know, you talk about the number of churches that are closing. It's a real passion for us and a real heartbreaking thing to see a church close. For us, it's even more heartbreaking when we see the church close and the facility becomes anything other than a church, right? Because if you think back over decades, generations, people's blood, sweat, and tears have gone into building these church buildings and maintaining these church buildings. And then a neighborhood or a community loses its gospel footprint when that church building becomes a coffee shop or a microbrewery or a car dealership or something of that nature, right? One of the things that you note in the book is that multi-campus facilities, a lot of churches that are launching new campuses, those that have a multi-campus model, are coming through church mergers. And I don't know that that's always been the case. I mean, you've been a pioneer in the church multiplication space as it relates to church planting through campusing. What have you seen significantly in that shift? What do you think is driving that shift with healthy churches campusing through mergers versus just launching new campuses on their own?
Well, my first experience, Bart, was with a merger was when I was serving at Willow Creek Church in Chicago, when we were looking for our third location, I should say. And I knocked on the door of a school. And there was to see if there was they were open to renting space to us. And they said, actually, there's a church meeting here already. And I didn't know that. I said, well, here's my card. If anything changes, let me know. Well, the next week, that church called me and said, hey, we understand that Willow Creek is looking to for this facility to use for a campus. And we are without a pastor. And this campus is huge. It was a former girls Catholic school, and it had a nice gym, a 1,000-seat auditorium, and all this kind of stuff on one end, and gym on the other. And it said, there's plenty of room for both of us to use the space. And so, can we talk? So I said, sure. So we sat down together and talked, and it became very apparent in our conversation. They weren't interested in sharing the space. They were interested in joining us. Mm. And I was like most pastors of the that when they first hear the word merger, like, no, that's not a good option. You know, we'll help you find a pastor or whatever, and we can maybe, be partners in this building together at different ends of the building. But they said, no, we really want to join you. And I said, well, let me, we're different. We do things differently. We're not like the typical church. And he said, no, that's why we want to join you. And so I thought, okay, you're talking me into this. And so we decided to go down that path. They had about 150 people. We had about 150 people. And, within 6 months or so, we joined and then relaunched it there. And today that they have outgrown that. They bought land, built a building, that campus, 3,000 people attending. And I thought, whoa. Before that we realized how much it was going to grow, how successful it turned out, I thought, didn't see that coming. I'll log that into my journal for future reference, and that turned out had a great outcome. And so after a few years later, when I went into consulting, Warren Bird, my co-author, who was with Leadership Network at the time, calls me up and says, Jim, are you seeing a lot of mergers in your church consulting with multi-site churches? And I said, I am. And he said, well, so are we at Leadership Network. We ought to write a book about it. So God is doing something different today in mergers. So what we discovered in that survey back in 2010 or so, 10, 11, of churches across the country, that about 30% of churches were multi-site churches were acquiring facilities through a merger.
Okay.
Then when we wrote our second edition of this book, an updated version, everything, by the way, in the updated version, in the first version is in the second version, just a whole lot more stories and more tools and all. The good news, we didn't have to repent of anything we wrote. It's all still valid. But what we discovered in that second survey about 10 years later, that it was over 40% now of multi-site churches were acquiring campuses through mergers. Wow. And so we thought, wow, this is really... this has clearly become a tool in the church's toolbox for growing strong churches and multiplying their their reach and their impact.
Yeah. I wrote down this quote from the book. We're using this term merger. We're throwing it around as if everybody knows what it is and everybody's happy to use it. The quote from the book says, you may not use the word merger. You may call the idea a restart, replant, partnership, adoption, collaboration, consolidation, satellite, unification, reunification, or even something more indirect like joining forces, etc. Language matters. I think that this is a really, really important thing for us to camp on. Why do you think that language matters so much? And why do you perhaps intentionally avoid the word merger in some contexts?
Well, yeah, I would agree with you. Words matter. They do convey more than just the face value. But when it comes to the word of merger, we all know that the word merger, when most people hear that word, there's baggage with that word, mainly from the business world where we hear about hostile takeovers and mergers that turn out bad and people get fired and, you know, and typically they don't turn out well, et cetera. And so there's a lot of baggage with that word. And so the conversation will start with that word because that's what everybody understands. But when we start describing it to the two congregations, when we go public with this, it's more about joining together. It's more about realigning. It's more about two rivers, a river and a stream coming together. You know, we use these different illustrations to explain. A merger is not a bad thing. It's not, it can be a good thing. And it can have a win-win. As a matter of fact, that's what we saw in this new kind of mergers. The old kind of mergers were seen as, and we did research on this, our book was the first book that was ever written about church mergers. There were some articles written about it in some magazines. There were some chapters in some church books, but no book had ever been written about it. But all of the literature before our book had said mergers basically don't work. They're a bad thing. You know, they're not a great strategy. And so, but we were seeing something different. And the old mergers of the past were like two drowning men who were trying to survive at the expense of the other. You know, they both drowned. The basic experience of the old mergers of the past was one larger church absorbing a smaller church. And 5 years later, the larger church would typically sell that property off. Those people would fade away. And 5 years later, those two churches was the same size as the original church, the bigger church before they merged. And now that other property is gone and the people are gone. And those were the good stories.
Yeah.
The bad stories is that two churches joined together to try to survive at the expense of each other. And 5 years later, they're both gone.
Yeah.
And so that was pretty much the experience of church mergers before the multi-site church movement. So now we have churches where it doesn't have to be a win-lose or lose-lose. It can be a win-win. And that's been the game changer.
Yeah. You think, my perception would be that a big part of the reason that churches, especially those that are stuck or stagnant or in decline, that might benefit from a merger, the biggest concern is typically what they're going to have to give up in order for the church to not just survive, but thrive, right? We're not talking about survival here. We really want each of these churches to thrive in their own context, but there is a certain level of give up of certain things, might be ideas, concepts, ministry philosophies, ministry styles, music styles, you know, curtain colors, like you name it, you're going to have to give something up. As you've walked churches through these mergers and you've seen a healthy church and a less than healthy church come together, what are some of the things that you've seen that have really triggered a positive momentum for those churches in those mergers? Like what's the posture of those churches? What does it take for two churches to come together to actually be able to join together, those two rivers to come together and thrive?
It's a great question. We like to describe the analogy of two churches having this conversation is like a dance, where in a dance, one partner leads and the other follows. You cannot have two leads. They step on each other's toes. Can't have two follows. They just stumble and fall over the place. It's very important that in a merger, both partners, they're equals in terms of value and worth, but one leads and the other follows. So that's just the nature of a dance. And this is what the merger conversation is like, a dance. It's very important at the beginning that both parties understand who the lead is and who the follow is. And it's always not about who's the biggest church or who has the most property. Sometimes the larger churches it's not about size or wealth. It's about health and trajectory, which way they're going. And so it's important to discern who that is. And so the question would be, the first question, there's three questions in this move, in this dance. One is, is this possible? Is this merger a possibility? And usually by the time they contact me, they've already decided it's a possibility. We live in the same general community. We may be the same denomination or not, but we have a lot of commonality in that regard, geography, and we know each other. And so it's possible. But then the second question is, okay, it's a nice idea, but is it really feasible? Are we compatible enough to do this? And we broke it down in our book. There are 25 distinct issues that every church merger has to wrestle through to land into deciding to join together. Now, most of those 25 issues are benign. They're not deal breakers, but there's usually four or five potential deal breakers, and they're different for both churches. And so if the two leadership teams or the two pastors, the two boards can work through those 25 issues and find the compromise or find out what has to give up, and usually the joining church is giving up making the greatest sacrifices, for sure. And you mentioned that, Bart. They're giving up their name, their property, their legal status. I mean, in a merger, one of the churches will dissolve, and it's usually that joining church. And so there's a lot that they give up. Now, the lead church, they have to maybe acquire debt, spend a lot of money to upgrade the facilities that have been deferred maintenance. There's staffing issues that they need to wrestle through. How do we help these staff that might be there transition either into our church or to another role in a generous way? So these are the issues that need to be worked through. But if they can work through those and say, you know what, it's not only possible, it's doable, it's compatible, it's feasible. So the third question is, all right, it's nice, it's a good idea, it's possible, we can do it, we've worked through the issues, but is it desirable? And that typically is decided by the local congregations, or at least the joining congregation, in a church-wide vote or affirmation of the board's decision, if it's not a congregational vote required. So all that to say is that that's the general process of what churches have to wrestle through. And, you know, this is happening left and right. And, 10 plus years ago when we first published the book, it was a foreign idea, I'm not sure I like this, but now it's becoming a mainstream tool in the church toolbox.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned something I think is really important for church leaders to hear, and that's that sometimes it's not about necessarily wealth of the church, but it's about health of the church, right? I've watched some very wealthy but very unhealthy churches die. I have a ministry colleague who helped close a church in Texas, and that church had $1.4 million in the bank when they closed. They had just gotten they'd reached a point of no return in terms of who was left in the church, what energy they had. There weren't even really enough people left to merge that church. And then I've seen other churches that, you know, they have a couple $100,000 in the bank, and they'll just keep on in this stagnant state, not making any real significant community impact, not reaching any lost people, not seeing people get saved, but just kind of doing their week in, week out worship services. And that's really the extent of what their ministry looks like. When you talk about mergers, you know, one of the things that you create a real distinction of, which is churches that are not merging necessarily for survival, but are merging for mission. Can you talk a little bit about what's the difference between a church that's merging for the sake of survival versus a church that's merging for the sake of mission?
Well, there's a huge difference there, Bart. As you know, if the goal is just to survive, you know, in a church experience that has really lost touch with its culture and its times, and it's in decline. Typically, those churches don't have any children in their nurseries. Probably not many have many teenagers, and so they're aging, and they're really kind of stuck. As one of our good friends, Ed Stetzer, has said, if the 1950s ever comes back to America, our churches will be ready for it. And unfortunately, Bart, that's where about 80% of our churches are at in America.
Yeah.
That's over 250,000 churches.
Yeah.
That are still thinking in the 1950s. Warren Bird, my co-author, just published last year a book with a couple of other writers about being a future-ready church, that we need to get ready for the 2050s. And the culture today is dramatically different than the culture of the last century. And so, unfortunately, a lot of those churches are stuck in the last century in their thinking. And so they're not going to survive in this current time. But they're always, and I always find it's not about age, it's about mindset. There's some older people in these churches that have a very much a kingdom mindset and say, you know what, our biggest goal isn't here to preserve something of the past that's no longer effective, but it's how do we be, we don't know how to reach our culture today like we did 50 years ago, 30 years ago, but you, another church down the street, you are. And you're like the men of Issachar that's described in Second Chronicles, who understand the times and know what to do. And so and God raises up those kind of churches in every generation. And so we can wither and die, or we can join with another church that is making a difference and have a second chapter, a rebirth, a replant, be infused with their life-giving DNA. And our building that was once full with people now is empty, could be full again, and we could have a life again. And, you know, that to me is being missional. It's like God's given us these facilities. We're going to lose them if we stay on the path that we're on, or we can decide to join with another church and throw our lot with them, let them infuse into our location their life-giving DNA, and we could live for another generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, becoming a future-ready church, you mentioned that. You and I were talking before we started recording about reading, and that was actually on my 2025 reading list. So I did read that book. I'll link to that one in the show notes here. I don't remember if this question was posed in the book itself. I heard the question asked by someone during the time that I was reading the book. So it might have been in the book, or I might just be blending ideas here, but someone asked the question, posing this question to the church, is your ministry model closer to 1950 or 2050? Because we are in time much closer to 2050 than we are 1950. And, you know, our typical assessment of many of the churches that we work with, that we coach through a revitalization or a replant, is that their ministry is often reflective of the season that was the heyday of the church. So if their heyday was the mid-1980s, or their heyday was the early 2000s, 2002, 2004, regardless of what decade or generation it was, that tends to be where the church sort of hangs its hat with its ministry model. And, you know, it's because, hey, there were a lot of people that got saved during that window of time. And a lot of people came to faith in Jesus and got baptized. And it was this kind of preaching and this kind of music and these particular ministry programs that led those people to Christ. And so we'll just keep on doing that because it worked in 1984. So certainly it will work in 2024 or 2025 or 2026, right? And obviously, cultural barriers, you know, the culture has changed so much. The culture that we're in, the culture that we're trying to reach, and our church culture can sometimes be a bit of a roadblock to actually effectively reaching the community that we're trying to reach. And we're not necessarily always as in tune to it. Yeah, do you remember those old commercials, Febreze commercials, where like the mom would go into the teenager's bedroom and, you know, he's playing video games and he doesn't notice anything, but she walks in and all of a sudden it's like dirty socks hanging all around the room because he's gone nose blind, right? He doesn't recognize that it stinks. And I think sometimes that happens in the context of our church, is that things just aren't as effective as they once were. Things kind of stink a little bit. We've got some stinky ministry, some stuff that's not working, but we're nose blind to it because we've been in it for so long and it's normal to us. And so sometimes it does take someone from the outside coming in and helping us sort of light the candle and go, okay, there's some stuff here that we could fix. And sometimes the fix is looking to another healthier, stronger church to come alongside, whether that's a permanent merger or a temporary partnership of some sort. Do you do much work with churches in terms of temporary partnerships, or when you're working with mergers, is it typically always going to be a two become one?
Well, when they call me, they already have begun the merger conversation. I want to go back just to one thing. Andy Stanley said this years ago, when it comes to getting stuck in a method that worked at one season or one decade or generation, and we get locked in there, and it's hard to get off of it. You know, we are married to the mission, we date the methods, mm-hmm. the models. And so even the multi-site model is a model. You know, it may be effective for another decade. It appears to be, it continues to grow, but 20 years from now, it may be an outdated model, but the mission is the same. And this is where we talk about being missional driven. Our mission is to make disciples, make more and better disciples. And that's what the church is all about. It's not about buildings. It's not about staff. It's not about worship styles. Those are all things, components. But at the end of the day, our mission is to make disciples and make a difference in our culture. It's interesting to use the word partnership. I always like to say to churches when they're calling me, they'll say, we're thinking about a merger, a partnership. I said, but let me hit pause real quick. When you're talking mergers are not partnerships. Partnerships implies equality, that you're two equal partners. And in a merger, there's one lead and one follows, as I mentioned already. And so, but many times what can happen is that a church maybe has in decline, but they've got a gym, they got a fellowship hall, they got a worship center that they're not large worship center they're not using. And maybe they could rent out that space to another church that's growing and needs it desperately and go to another part of the building or have a different hour to, you know, worship service. And so that's a partnership where two churches are working together, you know, under the same roof at different times or different parts of the roof. But that can evolve into, you know what, we get along so well and maybe we need a pastor, you need a building. Maybe we'd be wise to enter into a conversation about joining with you. So,
yeah, very interesting.
That's typically more the work that I do is helping churches walk through that merger conversation.
Okay. It's kind of like pre-marriage counseling to some degree, right?
Totally.
Yeah. right up to the wedding day.
I use that analogy. I always try, like a young couple, let me give you all the reasons why you shouldn't do this. You're going to have to give up stuff and, you know, you're going to have to just compromise on things that you think is important and that aren't that really that important in the long run. And things that are very dear to you, like the name of your church, you know, that might go away. But the outcome, well, what do we gain in this? Well, you get life. Mm-hmm. You get a second chapter. You get a second life.
Yeah. This isn't on the notes. I'm just freewheeling here. Okay. Sure. I'm going to ask you a question. What are some things that might derail a merger? If two churches are having the conversation and they think that it's something that they want to do, and then they pick up the phone and they call you and you get involved, what are some of the maybe two or three of the top things that would typically derail a merger that looks like it might be possibly good for both parties, but then it just doesn't pan out?
Great question, Bart. You know, first of all, let me just remind you that you already know is that in both our surveys, you know, over the last 20 years, 15 years, I guess you'd say, we asked the question, who initiated the conversation about a merger? It's not the large, bigger churches. It's the stuck or declining churches. Now, in the last survey, we've started to see more players like denomination leaders will get involved in the conversation, maybe initiate that conversation. And so, So larger churches have asked over the years, how do we initiate this conversation, Jim, without coming off as hostile or arrogant? Because we can see the church is in decline. We are desperately needing a place in that community. We could be great together, but we don't want to come off as, you know, the big church, you know, gobbling them up. And so we have some tools and some suggestions on how to begin that conversation. So now I forget that your question was
things that might derail. We've come together. We've started having some conversations, and then we bring you into the room. And you said one of the things that you're going to do is tell us all the reasons that we shouldn't do it. What are some of those things that might come up?
I have both churches work through the 25 issues, and especially the lead church. All right, I want you to do it separately, lead church. I want you to work through with you and your board or team or whatever. And how would you answer these questions? Join with us, this is what we will do or what we will happen if you join us. And then I have the other church leadership look at that, and I have them do their own and say, what's non-negotiable, what's non-negotiable? And then we start putting those together. But typically for the joining church, which is making the really biggest sacrifices, no doubt. First of all, the first question is, what's going to happen to the pastor, if there is a pastor there? And if that question can't get resolved to that pastor's, you know, comfortability, then it's not going to go anywhere. But typically that pastor is the one who often initiates the conversation with another church. Now, or it comes out of a relationship. And by the way, relationships, a prior relationship is the best soil between two church leaders for the merger conversation to even come to pass, because you know each other and you know each other's hearts and all that. But so what's going to happen to the pastor? That's the first question. The second, probably the biggest question that churches wrestle with, the joining churches, what's going to happen to our building? Are you just going to sell it off and keep the money for yourself or for something else? Or that's their concern. But if they say, no, we want to use it. Oh, so you're only interested in our building. So that's a delicate conversation. It can kind of cut both ways. But a third thing, what's going to happen to our staff? And staff of adjoining church are typically the most nervous and concerned because their job security is at stake. You know, the church rank and file church members, they may not like what's happening, or they may lose their church in their mind, but they're not losing their income, you know. So this is important that there's a good answer for what's going to happen to the staff, what's going to happen to our missionaries, things that we support. All these are the questions that churches have to work through together. Now, but what's the biggest thing that causes mergers not to happen? Someone doesn't want to give up control. Mm-hmm. Either that local pastor or a board member or a wealthy donor that may not even be a board member but has a lot of influence. And if we give up, if we turn our church over to someone else, then we're totally out of control. I mean, we have no control over this. So typically, that's the biggest issue that someone of influence can throw a wrench in it. And so it's about giving up control. That's the biggest part, the biggest challenge. The other thing perhaps is in a multi-site model, is this going to be a video sermon, delivered sermon? You know, that's a big obstacle for a lot of churches to overcome. A small church, when a larger church brings in their teaching by a video, way of a video.
Yeah.
But some the financials maybe are just too big. The debt's too great. Those are some of the things that derail a merger conversation. Now, I always like to say, even when a church, after we work through this, the process, and we realize we're not compatible enough, a no today could be a yes tomorrow. So a lot of these churches, they're one funeral away from going out of business. Mm-hmm. And 6 months later, I've had this happen many times, that merger conversation that went dormant, but kind of hit pause and don't think this is going to work out, comes back on the table.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. I can see that for sure. I'm looking at the clock here, and we could continue going on and on. You and I can talk about church all day, every day. In fact, we do talk about church all day, every day. I want to kind of wrap things up here. And you know, Jim, if you were sitting across the table from a pastor right now, someone who's been faithfully leading a church for 15 or 20 or 25 years, but they're watching their attendance decline, the congregation is aging, they're tired. And they're just not sure what to do next. What would you say to them? How would you encourage them?
Well, I would say thank you, first of all, for a pastor, for loving these people and shepherding them. And I think each has to decide what is the Lord leading me to do as a local pastor. I know when I came to my church in Woodman Valley Chapel in 1991, a church of about 400 in September, it was a church that was stuck. And a month later, the bank came to us and said, you know, your $1.8 million loan, we have to call the note. You need to pay $1 million off by the end of the year, or we'll have to call the note, close you down.
And so, wow.
I remember going to the church, for the church the next Sunday, and said, folks, I believe God called me here to be the captain of the ship, to sail this ship out of harbor. I inherited something that I didn't know was there, and a problem that I didn't cause. But you know what? As the captain of the ship, if the ship goes down, I'm not jumping ship. I'm going down with the ship. But if you'll join me and let's raise this money over the next 3 months, and let's sail this ship out of harbor. And guest, for those of you who are here today for the first time, if we don't raise this money in the next 3 months, you don't need to come back.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, we raised that money, Bart. And I tell that story because 8 years later, we grew to 5,000 people, larger building, all this sort of stuff. But that was a defining moment where I thought, you know what, I'm going to give my life to this church. I thought it was to grow it, but if it's to bury it because of circumstances beyond my control, I'm going to shepherd that church through that congregation. And so I like to say, sometimes if you're in a church that's in decline, you have several options. You can close it down, sell it, maybe give it to your denomination, the money, or to another church in the area. You can join with another church and renew that. That's the typical cause or outcome. Or you can decide to be a chaplain on the Titanic. And I'm not saying that to be cynical. That's the role some people will play. We're going to shepherd this church to its closing, till we close it, and then we'll, you know, give it a proper Christian burial, and you know, move to the next church to help maybe learn from those lessons from that one.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we're trying to avoid is, you know, I never want to have a conversation with someone and say, you may be the last person to turn the lights off and lock the door. Like, I don't ever want to have that conversation. So if and when there's a possibility to breathe new life, that the Ruach of God could actually breathe new life into these churches, that's what we're hoping for. That's what we're praying for. For the pastor who's sitting here and listening to this, and is willing to explore the possibility of a church merger, but doesn't really know where to start, what's the first step? How would you encourage them? What does a conversation with a potential church merger church look like?
Well, I just this week, last week and this week, I had a call from a church in a large city in Central Texas. I won't mention the city or the church. But it was a pastor there. He's 40 years old. He'd been there for 7 years. He and his wife and has got a couple children. They had been there for 7 years. He came to a church of 60 people. Now, in its heyday, it's a 70-year-old church. But in its heyday, a couple decades ago, it was had nearly 1,000 people attending in a 500-seat auditorium. A new auditorium. They have a community life center, a chapel, and on 16 acres of land. But 7 years later, he went from 60 to 50 people. And finally, he realized, you know, I've done everything I know to do to help lead this church forward. There's no children in the church, no teenagers. It's an older congregation. But right across, literally across the street, down the street, is a very vibrant multi-site church, highly respected in the area, meeting in a YMCA building. And they've outgrown that building. And so that young pastor, that 40-year-old pastor, called him up and said, We are, you know, in decline. We're not going to make it. But I know you are growing. You could use a facility. Could we have a conversation about joining with you and giving you our building and letting you use this building to bring life back into it and fill it up with people? And so that's a typical kind of conversation that happens where a local church pastor, a local leader, recognizes, and I think this is the first saying, what do you do if you're in that situation? First is define reality. Am I a strong, stuck, or struggling church? And that's where it starts. Second one, read the book, Better Together. We give a lot of good, we wrote this book with the idea that someone could read this book and follow our roadmap for that and have a merger outcome, not even having to call us. And so, and I've had some churches over the years say, we followed it, it went well, it works well when both churches are very compatible and they're all in agreement, it can go that well. But usually you need a third party to help navigate those that minefield. And so I think humility goes a long way for both churches to recognize we're not going to make it and we've lost our way and what used to work doesn't work anymore and we need help. And so to call to your denomination or your network or to a local church in the area, or church planter. One pastor I know had a strong church, but he was retiring, and he had been a mentor to a young church planter, you know, not too far away from his church. They were in the same denomination over in Oklahoma, this was. And as that pastor was starting to retire, he said, you know what? I'm retiring. I'm looking for a successor. I know you. You know me. You need a building. Why don't we join together? You become my successor. And that happened. That was 10 years ago, and that turned out to be a great outcome. And so I think initiate the conversation, I would say, Pastor. If a merger is a possibility that you could see as an alternative to closing the church down or just continue in a decline, this is a very viable option that is now becoming acceptable and not seen as a failure, but as an option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, man, that's the best place to land this, is that a church merger is not waving a white flag saying we give up, but it's actually finding new energy and new momentum and a new season of ministry. It is not a failure. It's not a quit. It's the fifth quarter, right? It's the next opportunity to continue to be on mission.
It takes a lot of courage.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of courage to say, hey, maybe could we start that conversation?
Yeah, man, really appreciate you. Jim, thank you so much for taking the time to be on our show. We're going to link to the book in the show notes of this episode. If someone did want to have a conversation with you, what's the best way for them to reach you?
Well, my email is jim@multisitesolutions.com, or you can go on LinkedIn and find me there, Jim Topperlin,
okay.
And that's where I kind of hang out. And so it's great to be with you, Bart, today. And thank you for the good work you're doing with churches in your movement as well.
Yeah, we appreciate that. Jim Topperlin, thanks again. Better Together, all about church mergers and multi-site churches. Thanks again. Appreciate you. For those of you who made it all the way to the end of this episode, well, congratulations, because this was a doozy. We talked a long time and a lot of stuff. Just a reminder that if you haven't yet subscribed wherever you listen to your favorite podcast, make sure that you do that. We release an episode on the 1st and the 15th of every month. And you don't have to remember if you subscribe. It'll automatically be delivered right to your phone or your mobile device. If you're watching on our YouTube channel, make sure that you subscribe there. God bless, and we'll see you next time.